Well, the panel today is titled The International Threat to Farm and Farmers, but I think this panel is also going to present a lot of the domestic threat. It's international and domestic, and I'm sure the panelists are going to be addressing this. So we have four panelists. First, we're going to hear from George Naylor, who's a corn and soybean farmer in Iowa. He's also the president of the National Family Farm Coalition and is currently a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against Monsanto. Then we'll be hearing from Lawrence Chimese. He's from Ghana, an organic agricultural activist from Ghana, and currently studying at the Institute for Social Ecology, studying social ecology there, and he considers himself an agricultural communicationist and ecological communitarian, and I'm sure he'll explain those terms for us so we all know what that means. And last but not least, we'll be hearing from Percy Schmeiser, who's been a farmer for over 50 years and is also involved in a lawsuit with Monsanto over property rights and farmers' right to save seed and use seed. George.
Well, it's wonderful to get together here with some of my fellow biotech guinea pigs. Especially ones that know that they are guinea pigs. And I'll bet some of you didn't know that we have an opportunity to enter Monsanto's whole wide world biotech laboratory today. You're surprised. No, well, as soon as you enter or exit this building, you are entering Monsanto's whole wide world biotech laboratory. We've actually been in that laboratory for some time now, along with Mother Nature's other creatures and living things. It seems like the greed that's driving modern genetically modified crop development seems to have no bounds. What Monsanto and the other biotech companies want is one whole wide world market. They want the farmers of the whole wide world to produce their genetically modified crops all over the whole wide world. They want consumers of the whole wide world to have to eat genetically modified food. And they want all of the citizens of the whole wide world to not ask questions or have the democratic right to stop or regulate their activities. They also want family farmers to be economically desperate and ill-informed so that they will adopt biotechnology crops. They want designer plants. They want to design plants so that they're fit for industrialized production, industrialized processing, and industrialized marketing, obviously, because that means more profit for their big corporations. It's really all other human and environmental values be damned. Obviously, from a farmer's point of view, the reality is that while some farmers might adopt biotechnology crops, overall, they will replace family farmers and local food supplies. And finally, these big corporations want to convince everybody that the food supply is so contaminated with biotech genes that there really isn't anything that can be done about it anyway. Now, just like American consumers, that I'm sure you're aware of, are misinformed by these corporations about biotechnology and what it could mean to their food supply, farmers are also the victims of corporate misinformation. For instance, not too long ago, I heard an executive from Pioneer, that's Pioneer DuPont, in Des Moines. He said he was telling farmers and other big executive type people in Des Moines, he says, why human beings have been conducting biotechnology for like over 6,000 years, ever since people have been making bread and beer. Now, that was just 6 months ago. I mean, so they're still repeating that kind of a lie. They're saying that biotech foods have been tested more than any food ever. And they told farmers that now we're just inserting one gene into this plant to do just this one thing, so the rest of the plant is perfectly fine, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, those are some of the lies that they've been telling farmers. So don't worry. And of course, they've told those lies basically because of those of you here that have been trying to educate farmers that there are real questions about these crops. Otherwise, they wouldn't even bother to tell these lies. And I think we need to pinpoint who the agents are that keep spreading these lies. First of all, of course, there's the giant members of the agribusiness complex. And that agribusiness complex is a key component of the military-industrial complex. Sometimes when people ask me what I do for a living, I tell them I raise corn and soybeans for the military-industrial complex. Some people understand that and some people don't. They kind of wonder what in the world I'm saying. But these companies intend, and the agribusiness complex intends to invade and conquer countries just as sure as any army. Government officials, you know, their campaigns and their retirement plans depend on these corporations. And then, of course, there are so-called farm groups that don't really represent farmers. I mean, I don't know if you all are aware that I think farmers are probably the most propagandized segment of our society. And if somebody from the outside came in objectively and looked at that, they would just be appalled because they've been given not only lies about biotechnology, but about every other aspect of their occupation. Some of these groups are the old commodity groups, like the National Corn Growers Association, the American Soybean Association, the Pork Producers Association, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. They all get funds from the big corporations by advertising in their newsletters, magazines, slick magazines. They will have a meeting out in my community. They'll say, come out and hear this great speaker. You know, you get a free steak dinner. So farmers will go for the free steak dinner. And then after the speech, they'll hand out cards to join. And if you join, you'd get free soybean seed. You might get free drugs for your cattle, whatever. So that when you figure it out, well, actually, if I join and I get this free stuff, it really doesn't cost anything to join. So some people will join, so they can say that they have members, when in fact, none of their people really know what these organizations are doing. And of course, on top of the pile is the American Farm Bureau Federation, which is really just a giant insurance company that finances a network of right-wing activists in rural America. To illustrate how phony that organization is, in my county, which is virtually 100% rural and corn and soybeans everywhere, the county organization had their county convention and they passed resolutions. One of the resolutions came from the state organization and it said that farmers should support co-ops and that co-ops should provide services such as planting, spraying, and harvesting. Okay, now I haven't met a farmer yet that thought that made sense, because they said, well, hell, my landlord could call up the co-op and just say, well, come on out and plant and spray and harvest. I don't need this tenant anymore. Okay, so no farmer would ever support that. And I asked the local newspaper publisher who was there, I said, well, didn't one farmer raise their hand and say that they thought maybe that didn't make sense? He said, not one farmer raised their hand about any of the resolutions. Okay, so you can see that this organization is not what it claims to be when it goes to Washington, D.C. and says that it represents over 5 million farm families. And I can envision a political cartoon. You remember the three monkeys? You have one monkey representing the biotech companies, and they have their hands over their eyes. They see no evil. Another monkey, the Farm Bureau and those fake farm organizations, they are like this. They hear no evil. But over here, you have all the consumers of the world with their hands over their mouth, and they say, we will eat no evil. Now, I want to take some time here to talk about this thing of making farmers economically desperate, because that is much of their strategy, which puts a lot of money in their pockets and also makes farmers want to take on use their technology. People don't really seem to understand farm economics, and that includes farmers, because of that propaganda for so long and because of a political repression. You have to understand that during the Cold War, farmers organizations that stood up for farmers were destroyed because they didn't necessarily have the right things to say about the Korean War, for instance, or what corporations wanted people to hear about farm economics. lots of times we hear explanations of why things are the way they are in farm country, and they may seem illogical to some people, but they're not. And lots of times they will blame the government, when in fact it is really just the marketplace. And after all, the government is being run lock, stock, and barrel by these big corporations. But the thing you have to realize is that farm prices and the response that farmers make to different farm prices are different than other economic entities in a society. They always say, well, okay, if we got too many farm commodities, why don't farmers produce less? Okay. And so then they say, well, they must be producing less because they're getting too many, they must be producing too much because they're getting subsidies. Okay? Well, the reality is that when the farmers' prices go down, they have no alternative but to maintain their standard of living or to keep paying their bills than to try to produce more. Okay? And that has nothing to do with subsidies. That's just the nature of farmers. And the other reality is that if Mother Nature treats farmers well and we get more than we need in 1 year in the free market system, that drives prices down. Okay, so that makes farmers want to produce even more the next year. And it puts more pressure on their land, and it makes them want to take on destructive technologies. So a civilized society would not let that be the system that prices agricultural commodities. And in fact, in this country, since 1933, from 1933 to 1936, we did not price agricultural commodities in that manner. In fact, from 1933 to 1953, farmers were guaranteed a fair price, a minimum price, and that price was adjusted for inflation. Finally, agribusiness got its way in 1996 with the Freedom to Farm Act, where that price floor was totally destroyed. And now, that is why farmers are dependent on subsidies. It's not subsidies that create low prices. Low prices is a constant in farming. It's the subsidies that were required to prevent the whole farm economy from collapsing. These people do not care if farmers go broke. They just do not want all the farmers to go broke at the same time. And of course, they want them to be able to go to the banks to get their loans to buy the biotech seed and the chemicals to put the crop in. So, in order to price agricultural products fairly, whether we have very much concentration in the agribusiness industry or not, this is a fact that that goes back for centuries or even millennia. What you need is a fair price, a floor under farm prices. That floor has to adjust to inflation so that it's relevant to everything else that's priced in society. Second of all, you need a reserve. If Mother Nature does give us a good crop this year, well, all that crop doesn't have to go on the market to drive prices down. Some of it has to be stored away in case you don't have a good crop next year. I mean, that goes way back to biblical wisdom, when Joseph told the Pharaoh that he needed to store up the grain for 7 years so that he would be ready for the 7 bad years to come. So you have to have a reserve. Those two things are totally absent in the present farm policy of this country. Okay, and third, then you have to have an ability to lay land aside or conserve it when we have too much land or when technology lets us produce more crop on less land. Otherwise, that land will be producing more of those same crops and exposing that soil to erosion and adding more nitrogen fertilizer and chemicals to the water supply. Okay, another ramification that you all, I know, should be familiar with, and that's corporate livestock factories, where thousands of animals are put into factories, you know, in very inhumane conditions, where these animals never see the light of day and never get fresh air. Okay, the reason we're having that is because under the current farm policy, the price of corn and soybeans, which is the main ingredients in manufactured feed, which can be shipped anywhere in the world, is so cheap that those big factories can actually feed their animals cheaper than a farmer who has a diversified operation can feed them. They just get on the phone and order up all this manufactured feed to feed thousands of animals. They don't have to worry about soil erosion or water pollution from raising the crops. They don't have to worry about whether they're supporting their family or their community. They just get on the phone and order this stuff cheap because it's there. Okay, that should not be. And that's what would be denied them if we had a good farm bill with a fair price support, a reserve and conservation set-asides. Now, the other tragedy about all this is, like I said, that feed can be shipped all over the world. So this agricultural system that we've set up in the United States will affect every farmer around the world. When the Chicago Board of Trade prices grain, it is not pricing grain just for the United States, for farmers in the United States. It's pricing grain for every farmer in the world, basically. Every farmer knows that if 50 cents goes off the price of corn in Chicago, then 50 cents is going to go off the price of their corn also. So, and the free trade agreements that we all know about, they are to ensure that the United States farmers will not get a fair price, and consequently, other farmers around the world will not get a fair price, and that their countries are hamstrung so that they cannot do anything about it. That's what fair trade or free trade policy is all about, whether it's WTO or NAFTA. One other thing about that's important to understand about some of this technology that we're dealing with, like Roundup Ready, that Percy can tell you about. Roundup Ready, they're making every crop under the sun Roundup Ready now. First it started with soybeans, and I guess canola, and now it's corn. My neighbor raised Roundup Ready corn, and they're coming out with Roundup Ready alfalfa, so that you can spray your crop and kill the weeds, but not kill the crop. And I don't know if you, most of you might be old enough to remember the neutron bomb. That was going to be the greatest weapon ever invented, where it would blow up and it would kill every living thing, but leave the buildings and that in place. Well, so Roundup Ready is really the neutron bomb of agriculture. And what it is going to allow happen is the expansion of soybean production, canola production, corn production, whatever crop they want to raise, all over the world. Because if there's a piece of land there, they do not have to worry about, well, let's see, what kind of weird plants are going to grow up there as weeds, because they can almost surely count on Roundup to kill every weed, every plant that comes up other than the crop. And so we are seeing the expansion of soybean production in Brazil and other countries by destroying the natural landscape and planting with Roundup Ready soybeans. And actually, in Brazil, that's not the case yet, but I see a study by a group of USDA people that went to Brazil, and they came back to say, well, what are the things that are stopping Brazil from expanding? And one of the things was that Brazil outlaws the use of Roundup. And if they could just get Brazil to legalize the use of Roundup, believe me, there will be no limit as to how many soybeans they will produce in Brazil, which will mean lower prices for farmers all over the world and more livestock raised in confinement in these livestock factories. So I see it's time for me to quit. And anyway, what we're going to have to do, obviously, is educate our fellow citizens, take back our government. We need to join with other people around the world to create democratic institutions that represent we the people and our Mother Earth. Thank you.
Greetings to everybody once again. Just a voice test. I used to have a very deep Africa tonation in my speech, and people find it difficult sometimes to understand me. So far, these few words I've spoken, is it clear?
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll try to look at Africa. We'll look at the threats, international threats. We also have internal threats anyway, but we want to look at the international threats to our farmers and to our farms. And we identify poverty as a first main threat to African farmers and farms because it comes out of policies, you know. We have a lot of unhelpful policies that the IMF and the World Bank have forced on our governments one way or the other. And the disastrous consequences are that farmers are worse hit because the backbone of many African economies is agriculture dependent. And we want to identify poverty as the first international threat to our farms and farmers. And we want to go ahead and talk concerning, maybe modernization and other aspects that forms a threat to our farms and farmers. I would like to stick to my script a little bit more because I don't take time. I would just go wild and I wouldn't even talk about a quarter of what I want to say before the time is up. I agree that I'm limited by time, just 20 minutes. So Africa's lagging agricultural production is frequently blamed on its failure to adopt more productive farming technologies. That is what they keep on telling us, that you people are not doing so well because you are not adopting the factory farming systems, the modernizations and all that, and they keep on referring to the Green Revolution and the successes that they achieve in Latin America and Asia, and they try to always coerce us into doing some of these things. I use the word they, and I expect you to understand who the they are referring to over here. And to talk about modernization in farming, let's look at the Green Revolution. It brought about the use of seeds and plants that require high chemical inputs, you understand me? And most of our farmers are poor because policies don't favor them so much. And gradually, most of them lost their farms to bigger farms because our African governments always rely on big-time farming, factory farming, you will call it so. They believe, or they have been made to believe that this is what can be able to feed our people. So you find, factory farming springing up in Ghana, and they come with all sort of problems. And some of the problems are that small-scale farmers lose their land to these big-time farmers. And because they lose their land to these big-time farmers, they are not able to continue with their farming. Already subsidies have been removed on their inputs, and they migrate from maybe the rural areas to the urban centers. And once there, they are not able to get the jobs they want to. So you find a paradox here. The Green Revolution, they say it was a success because there was food in abundance. Especially in the 1990s, that is when famine and drought and hunger hit Africa also the most. And that was the period that they were hailing the Green Revolution as a big success. And so there was actually hunger in the midst of abundance. These people who lost their lands to the big corporate farmers have to go to the cities in search of jobs. And their jobs were also not there. So what do they have to do? They have to still wallow in poverty and to even have money to be able to buy food. This food, which is so-called, there in abundance, was a problem. So we can just see that the Green Revolution actually wasn't a big success, primarily because of the external input factor. Let's see globalization. International trade policies. The domination of the food chain by corporate interests, unequal land, ownership and displacement of small farmers are the major forces driving rural poverty and hunger. For many agencies that are seeking to alleviate famine and cope with Africa's crippling poverty, globalization is a key and controversial issue. We have many agencies coming into Africa all the time. Everybody coming with their tailored solution to our problems, and some are genuine and some are actually just towing the line of, I call them in quotes, imperialist groups. And they have sometimes identified globalization as a key issue, as a threat to our farms and farmers. I will elaborate further. Those who favor the process, we all know of the IMF very well. And the former head of this organization, Michel Camdessos, contends that it will lead to modernization of economies. That is what they always tell us, and that the removal of trade barriers and to the elimination of want. There's a great want still, even a want for basic things. And they tell us that globalization can eliminate want as well. It says the prospects, let me quote, are good for achieving more rapid poverty reduction, reduction and faster growth. But the argument is that the trade liberalization has harmed Africa, and that the freer trade, especially in agricultural produce, has worked to threaten or destroy the livelihoods of millions of farmers and to keep the people poor. The perverse way that farm subsidies work in both the United States and the European economic community is another threat to us. You know, these communities, these countries subsidize their farmers, and yet they come to tell us that don't subsidize your farmers. So production is so cheap in these areas, you produce food in abundance and export them to Africa. We find, foodstuff or food, items brought from Europe and from the United States cheaper than what we are able to produce ourselves. And consumers actually will want the cheapest. They go in there, and our small-scale farmers are thrown out of business because there is no subsidy for them. And that is some of the things that globalization is doing for us. Let me just give an example that I got from a BBC report last year. According to the report, one Salfamide Okwenno, that's a typical African name, she's an 87-year-old grandmother living in Kenya's Busia district. For decades, her family had grown sugarcane and made good living from it. But now it is threatened by trade policies which enable foreign sugar exporters to sell sugar more cheaply in Kenya than local producers. Her granddaughter, who is a journalist, Florence Machiano, says that her grandmother cannot afford to buy sugar. Yet the crop that produces it stretches as far as the eye can see from her home. Such a big paradox. Sugarcane, you use it to produce sugar, and yet the sugarcane grower cannot buy sugar in her own country because of what? The process of globalization. It's thrown her out of business. A family business of generations has been destroyed by the process of globalization. And this is just one of the ill. Let's talk about this same BBC report that was monitored late last year. It quoted Kenya's Director of Internal Trade, Seth Otieno, as saying that liberalization of trade has been a disaster for many in Kenya. Globalization is a curse to many sectors, especially agriculture in this country, he has said. That is a direct quote from him. And in Swaziland, the import of sugar products from the European Union countries has undermined the local industry. It has thrown many people, especially small-scale farmers and sugarcane producers, out of business. It is estimated by the Action, a group called the Action for Southern Africa. It is estimated in their March 2002 report that the sugar industry has lost about 16,000 jobs. And a further 20,000 have gone into transport and packaging. Those in favor of globalization say Africa needs better economic management and more trade liberalization. These changes, according to the former IMF boss, will enable it to be part of the new economic partnership offered by globalization, and so increase economic growth. Many African leaders accept globalization as a long-term goal, but say that it must be accompanied by reform by the developed countries to make the terms of trade fairer to Africa. That means they agree that the terms of trade are usually not fair and do not favor Africa. President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, he is an originator of our pro-globalization new partnership for Africa's development, NEPAD, says that Africa must embrace the process, but warns that it is leading to rising inequalities between and within countries. He says governments must reshape and redirect its impact. The European Union and the U.S. financial support for their farmers give them big advantages in trade and ruins Africa's farmers by subjecting them to unfair competition. I've already mentioned this, and these countries protect their own farmers, but they demand that African countries cut or remove subsidies from our own farmers, I mean, who need them the most. Better?
Yes.
Sorry. Am I speaking too fast anyway?
No, you're doing good.
Okay. Yeah. So the case of this grandmother of Kenya that I mentioned is a classical example of what, I mean, cutting subsidies to our own farmers have done to us. We're talking about agricultural production strategies also as a threat to our farmers. You know, African agricultural policies in the last decade have focused on export and high-value crops as income generation for economic growth to increase staple food crop productivity, higher yielding or disease and pest resistant improved varieties have been introduced, and farmers encouraged to use synthetic pesticides and fertilizers in their production. The structural adjustment programs and economic liberalization measures have shifted provision of inputs and services to the private sector. The measures involve in the dismantling of privatization of state-controlled crop commodity and food grain marketing boards, phasing out subsidies on agrochemical inputs, opening up local and national markets, and reducing government control over pricing and distribution of agricultural inputs and produce. I want to just ask, how far have these policies and programs actually benefited our resource-poor farmers? The answer is obvious. Negative. It has had a negative impact on us, and it can be seen really on the ground if you go over there. People who are familiar with Africa and our farming systems and how our governments are religiously adhering to this policy of high-tech agriculture, high-input agriculture, as if to say that without pesticides, without synthetic chemicals and fertilizers, there can never be any agricultural production. Have they forgotten so soon that before the introduction of this so-called high-input agricultural productive systems, we were still producing our food and we were not having much problem till now? And I dare say that most of the problems encountered in agriculture today, pest problems and disease problems, has been because of the continual use of pesticides and synthetic fertilizers in our agricultural system. Improved varieties and pest susceptibility. Improved varieties of maize in Ethiopia. I want to use two countries for a case study here that I was involved in. Maize in Ethiopia and cowpea in Ghana have been energetically promoted for small-scale farmers to increase their productivity, income, and food security. These varieties are directly responsible for increased pesticide use by farmers and often of non-approved and acutely toxic products. They are far more susceptible to attack by insects, pests, than local varieties in the field or in storage. Ghanaian farmers do not apply any insecticide when growing local varieties in the field. That's local varieties of cowpea. But they need to spray up to 5 times per season to avoid pest damage on the so-called improved varieties. What is wrong with our local variety? You bring an improved hybrid, high-tech seed that requires pesticide to survive at the expense of our local varieties already adapted to the environment, are disease-free, and can withstand a lot of our drought conditions and our pests. We don't need any pesticides to grow those ones, but we rather need pesticides to grow the so-called high-tech, high-yielding varieties. And this is a problem that we need to look into. 5 of the 10 products commonly applied are intended for use on cotton only. I'm talking about cowpea farmers. Most of the time are so much frustrated that the chemicals they use don't seem to have any effect on the pests or disease that they are trying to control, such that they always require chemicals that are, in quotes, more powerful than a previous chemical use. And the more chemicals they use, the more resistant these pests become, and the more they come back in their numbers. I mean, if you kill 100 today, tomorrow you have 1,000 pests more coming to your farm, and you need something more dangerous than you have used previously. That leads them to sometimes resort to dangerous pesticides that are not supposed to be used on food crops. You know, pesticides that are used on cotton and to some extent even our cocoa plants are used sometimes by these cowpea farmers to control pests because they think that is most powerful. And this leads to all sorts of food poisoning cases that is very, very rampant in Africa. We all know that DDT is banned worldwide by the World Health Organization. But it's strange and it's very sad to mention that some of these chemicals find their way onto our local markets, usually unlabeled, and these farmers take delight in using them, primarily because they do not understand the implications behind the use of these pesticides. A lot have complained that after spraying, they have felt very dizzy, and some have even fainted after spraying and have been rushed to hospital. Some have foamed in the mouth, some have had respiratory and chest congestions and other things. And it is until we started educating them and letting them know about some of these pesticide poison cases that they realized that all these issues had been because of the chemicals they were using. And we have a lot of examples about these pesticide poison incidents for which we have documented. We've documented a lot of this, and some have also been corroborated by the state agencies, the country's Ministry of Food and Agriculture, and so forth. Most vegetable and cowpea farmers that we worked with in Ghana explained that few have been able to adopt the improved varieties because they lack the cash to buy insecticides. Again, these varieties that are being forced on them subtly, that this is the best for you. What you are used to is not. What you are used to is not what you must do. You must actually use these so-called improved varieties. And we've got some research institutions like the Savannah Agriculture Research Institution, based in northern Ghana, coming up with a lot of so-called improved varieties. These improved varieties have been around for some time now. And 2 years ago, this same research institution came up to say that the pesticides that the farmers are using on these improved varieties is causing a lot of mess in the environment, and we are recording a lot of pesticide poison incidents because farmers will have to sometimes sell off cowpea that have been preserved with these dangerous pesticides, which is supposed to at least stay for 6 months before consumed. Maybe after staying for 2 months and they are out of cash, they don't have any alternative, they sell it up in the market. You, the innocent consumer, just goes in innocently and buy this as food, and you end up having a lot of poison symptoms. In fact, it was recently recorded that we have a lot of deaths in Ghana due to pesticide poison incidents. And this was linked to agriculture, that the misapplication of pesticides by farmers on vegetables and of food crops have caused all this mess. I can't end this without talking a little about genetic engineering, the role of genetic engineering in the picture, you know. how it also threatens our farmers. And GE crops, as has been elaborated here, they promote monoculture, and our farmers usually are not used to that kind of farming. I mean, biodiversity is encouraged in on most of our farms, and this is also serving as a threat to most of our farmers. And I want to say that recently something happened on the African continent when some food aid was pushed on some southern African nations, and these food aids were genetically modified foods, and there was a big resistance in most parts of southern Africa, and some yielded to pressure, but others did not yield to pressure. A country like Zambia was able to stand its ground and even stop the distribution of some of these genetically engineered food in a particular refugee camp, something that the World Food Program was going to do. And the Zambian government actually had information from the United States. They sent a team of scientists to South Africa, Belgium, United States, the UK to, get information about what GMO foods really are. And based on that information they had, they were able to stand on their ground. Thank you very much.
Now you're going to hear from Percy Schmeiser.
First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for bringing me to St. Louis to be able to give a presentation here today. I always enjoy to come to St. Louis, and I guess you know the reason why. But anyway, I spent about a week here last September, so it's my second time here. What I'm going to talk about this morning is that it's not what could happen or may happen anymore to us in the Northern Plains and on the prairies in Western Canada, but what has happened with the introduction of GMOs in 1996 when regulatory approval was given in both our countries. Poorer quality, more chemical use, but worst of all, the control of farmers through contracts, and also the rights of farmers being taken away and not being able to use their own seed. So that's what is unknown. And just to give you an example, the dangers of chemicals. In our province, we have less than a million people. We use 1/3 of all the chemicals, herbicides, insecticides in Canada in our province. But we have the highest rate of cancer in Canada in our province. So that is telling us. And where is this rate of cancer? It's amongst farmers, and now it's in our infants, less than one year of age. I'm going to go back, I think, because there's a lot of people have not heard my presentations, and I'd like to go back right to the beginning. Who am I? I'm a farmer from Western Canada, and I've primarily been farming since 1947, growing wheat, canola, and other crops, but primarily a wheat and canola farmer. And I also was known in Western Canada as a canola developer, and I should say, when I say us, I mean my wife and myself. And we've been doing that since 1947 when canola was known at that time as rapeseed. And over the years, we were able to develop varieties of canola that was resistant to various diseases we had on the prairies. And I was a seed saver, meaning like hundreds of thousands of farmers throughout the world, I was saving my seed from year to year. Besides being a farmer, I was also a member of the legislature, a member of parliament in my province, and I was on many, many agricultural committees, both provincially and federally. That gives you a brief background of where I'm coming from. Now, in 1998, Monsanto laid a lawsuit against me, and it was a lawsuit of patent infringement. And in that lawsuit, there was a number of items, but principally they said I was growing their GMO canola without a license or permit from them, and therefore violated their patent. They had also accused me of stealing the seed or getting it somehow illegally. And at that time, two important things came into our minds. And why did we stand up to Monsanto at that time? Number one, we realized that there could be 50 years of research and development loss of our pure seed being contaminated and polluted by a GMO, which we did not want. And the other issue, we realized immediately here farmers could lose their right to use their seed from year to year. And we felt, my wife and I felt, that right should never ever be taken away from any farmer by anyone. And I think the second issue is why we really stood up to Monsanto. So there was 2 years of pretrial. Federal Court of Canada, one judge. I had no choice. I wish I could have had a judge and jury with some farmers on, but I didn't have that choice. So in the pretrial, Monsanto withdrew all allegations against me I had ever obtained or seed illegally. But they said it did not matter. The fact they said they found some GMO canola plants in the ditch along my field, I violated their patent. That is the basis it went to Federal Court of Canada. The trial lasted 2.5 weeks. I won't tell you all the details, but I'll tell you some of the major decisions of what the judge came down with. Number one, he ruled, it does not matter how Monsanto's GMO seeds plants gets onto any farmer's field. And he went on to specify how this could happen. And he said cross-pollination. But direct seed movement is the biggest cause that we found. And he said direct seed movement, especially by wind, birds, bees, animals, floods, it doesn't matter how it gets there. It becomes Monsanto's property. And that is what I think disturbed and alarmed farmers and property owners throughout the world, how you could lose something that you work for. An organic farmer could lose overnight your rights to your own property and your choice is taken away. And when this happened, he also went on to say that all my profit from all my canola fields from 1998 goes to Monsanto. And all my seeds and plants that we developed over 50 years goes to Monsanto. I had taken some samples, sent them to the University of Manitoba, where scientists checked and research people checked my seeds from all my fields, and some of my fields had no contamination. Some had 1%, 8%, and so on. And the judge ruled, even from those fields, he said because I was a seed saver, using my own seed, there was a probability there could be some of those seeds or genes in those fields, in those seeds also. It all goes to Monsanto, and I'm not allowed to use my seeds or plants again. We then immediately applied to the Federal Court of Appeal. And that took another year or year and a half until a year ago last spring. And then they came down and they upheld the first judge's decision. Even though they did not agree with all the first judge's opinions, they still upheld the first judge's decision. So where did that go from then? There. In November, we applied to the Supreme Court of Canada. And today, I'm really jubilant. It's been one of the greatest last few days since Monsanto laid a lawsuit in the last 4.5 years ago, or 5 years ago, because last week, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in my favor that they will allow... They will allow my case to be heard in the Supreme Court of Canada, and it will be on the whole issue of patenting life forms. What makes us very confident is that in December, the Supreme Court of Canada came down what we call the Harvard mouse case, where Harvard University wanted to patent a mouse which they had put a gene in, and that they had invented or created this mouse. And the Supreme Court, in their decision in December, said you cannot patent a higher life form in Canada. And that includes a cedar plant. So that's why I'm very jubilant. And it's, you know, if anything, good news, it was the best news my wife and I heard for 5 years. And believe me, it has not been easy to fight a multinational corporation as an individual or as a family for 5 years. And that could not have happened if I did not have the support and the encouragement and the financial help from people all over the world and organizations and foundations. But it shows you what can be done if you stand up and you keep at it and you have a commitment. And we felt it's so important always that farmers always have that right to use their own seed. I think that I have a little time on this, and I'll go. There's the whole issue that I mentioned of what you can lose with poor quality and less yields. But there's another issue, and that's the freedom of rights, the freedom of speech, and that's contracts, where Monsanto gets farmers to sign contracts, which basically takes all their light, their freedom of speech, rights, to use your own seed, and so on, away. And I have some of those contracts, but I think I left it over there. But it doesn't matter. One of those contracts in my hand. It's not the latest one, because there's a new one for the year 2003. And in the year 2003, they have another clause added, and I'll refer to it a little later on. But I'll briefly tell you what this contract says. Number one, you can never use your own seed. Number two, you always have to buy the seed from Monsanto. Number three, you must pay Monsanto $15 an acre technology charge each year. Number four, you must sign a non-disclosure statement. If you commit some violation of this contract, you can say nothing to the press, you can say nothing to the neighbor what Monsanto has done to you. So your freedom of expression and freedom of speech is taken away. The next clause is you must permit Monsanto's police, and believe me, they have a large police force. In Canada, we call them Gene Police, and they're former ex-Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And you must permit that police force to come onto your land, even though you signed this contract for 1 year, for 3 years, and they can go into your granaries, they can go onto your land, your ceded land, they can ask for your income tax records, your farming records, to see and check on you if you violated something of this contract. And the last part of this now is that the third, or the last clause they've added into 2003 is that you cannot sue Monsanto for any reason. If something goes wrong with your crop, you know, you cannot sue Monsanto. So it takes your rights of taking Monsanto to court. So that's all in this particular contract. You might ask, why in the world did farmers ever sign this contract in our countries? And some of the reasons are this. They were told, increased yields, more nutritious, less chemical use. And I think the last issue, less chemical use, is what really caught the farmer's ear. But within 2 and 3 years, what happened is that canola especially developed into a super weed, where now it takes a multitude of new and more powerful toxic chemicals to kill it. So now we're using more chemicals than ever, the yield is down, and the quality is way poorer. You never hear them talking about quality, but that quality has gone down, and I won't go into that. But that is some of the reasons why the farmers signed that contract in 1996. Now, besides that, in control, and I think it's important because you never hear this with the introduction of GMOs, how did they control that contract or police that contract? Here's an advertisement from Monsanto advertising that if you think your neighbor is grown GMO canola without a license, you should inform on your neighbor to Monsanto. And in return for that, you get a free leather jacket from Monsanto. You talked about getting a meal or some free chemicals. Here you get a free leather jacket from Monsanto if you inform and rap on your neighbor, as we call it. And when Monsanto gets this information, they'll send normally always two of their police or gene police to a farmer's home. And believe me, what happens is not nice. You'd think this can't happen in our two free countries, but it is happening. And they'll say to a farmer, we got this tipper rumor. And a farmer will say, you know, this tipper rumor that you're growing GMO canola without a license. And a farmer will say, no, I never bought your seed. I had nothing to do with you. And they'll say to a farmer, you're lying. We're going to get you if you don't confess, and we'll drag you through the court system. We'll do to you what we've done to Percy Schmeiser. You won't have a farm left. Now, when these police leave a farmer's home, and to me as a former politician, I think it's one of the worst things that could happen in our society, because a farmer or his wife will think, was it this neighbor, that neighbor, the neighbor over here? Now we have the breakdown of farmers' not trusting one another, a suspicion. We have the breakdown of our rural social fabric. Our culture is being broken down by Monsanto's ruthless contract and policy. And I, as I said, that's one of the worst things that could happen. I'm a third generation farmer in Canada. My grandparents came from Europe, first from Europe to the United States and then to Canada. And my grandparents, my parents, had to work together to build our society, our infrastructure, our roads, our schools, our hospitals, and so on. Now we have that rural social fabric being broken down, and in return we got a culture of fear, of farmers not trusting one another, suspicion. It doesn't only stop there. I also have with me what farmers call extortion letter. I have many of these letters. We don't know how many thousands of these extortion letters that have been sent out, but I do know they're still being sent because I just got some just lately. And in it, it will say to a farmer, we have reason to believe that you might be growing Monsanto's GMO canola on so many acres. And it'll estimate 100 acres, 200 acres, 500 acres, whatever. And in lieu of us not taking or possibly not laying a lawsuit against you, send us 50,000, 100,000. I got one right here now, $191,000. And we may or may not take you to court. Then the third in that letter also, it states, you are not allowed. You must sign a non-disclosure, not to show this letter to anyone, not to tell anyone what we have done to you. And so, again, the farmer's freedom of speech and expression is taken away. Can you imagine the fear in a farm family when they get a letter from a multi-billion dollar corporation saying, send us $100,000, we may not take you to court because we think you might be growing some GMO seeds or plants without our permission. To intimidate farmers, they even send letters to farmers that have not grown canola on acres and say, send us so many thousands of dollars because we think you might be growing on it. One farmer, in fact, I got this letter with me today, it was sent on bushland, but doesn't even grow a crop. We estimated you're growing canola on there, send us $50,000. But it was a matter, this farmer they sent it to because it was one of the farmers that testified on my behalf at court. So every farmer that testified on my behalf, Monsanto has come after. You see the fear and control they want to put into farmers. They'll also do other things. They'll take an airplane or a helicopter and they'll fly over a farmer's field, canola field or soybean field, and normally in flowering time, and they'll drop a Monsanto Roundup Ready herbicide spray bomb. And it'll cover generally about 30 feet across. And then they'll come back about 10 days after the chemical has time to activate, and they'll see what has happened. If the farmer's crop has died where they hit with the spray bomb, they know the farmer wasn't using Monsanto's GMO, canola, or soybeans. If the crop hasn't died and has been resistant to Roundup, they know the farmer was using Monsanto's GMO, canola, or soybeans. That is the method of control and suppression of farmers' rights. They go into farmers' fields without farmers' permission. They trespass. And I'm not scared to use it in Monsanto's hometown. They steal and they take farmers' seeds and plants against a farmer's permission. And if a farmer catches them in his field and say, you're trespassing, you're stealing, you're taking our seeds and plants, they'll laugh at a farmer and say, take us to court and we'll drag you through the court system and you won't have a farm left. It's suppression of farmers' rights. What farmer or any individual has $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 to fight Monsanto in court? And years, like in my case, my own legal bill has been over $200,000. 5 years of stress and fighting. And Monsanto knows that, and they work under the culture of fear. I could go into many other issues. I think the whole debate can be divided into three categories. The one I'm in, the property rights of farmers versus the intellectual property rights of multinationals through patent law. The issue of how patent law can take farmers' rights away, which a judge ruled. And even in Canada, we have a federal law that states a farmer always has that right to use his seed from year to year. The judge ruled that the patent law is over and above that right. And I'm sure the Supreme Court is going to overturn that. Now, those, that is some of the issues of in this whole debate. The second issue, I think, is the health and safety of our food, the dangers of GMOs with the introduction of it, and then the third issue, the environment. But I primarily like to always concentrate on that first issue. I think that what I have seen as a farmer is the two important points that have come out with the whole introduction of GMOs. These are knowns, not supposing. Number one, there's no such thing as containment. You cannot contain a life-giving form or a GMO once you put it into the environment. You cannot contain a life form, and it will spread. And whether it's through cross-pollination or direct seed movement, it will spread. There is no such thing as containment. And when I hear people say, well, we'll keep a buffer strip of 50 feet or half a mile, it's ludicrous, because you cannot control a bird, a wind, a whirlwind, whatever. So it will move, not only by pollen, but a lot by direct seedment and on direct seed movement. And on the prairies, that is primarily our rate of contamination comes from direct seed movement. The other issue, first of all, now we have no such thing as containment. There is no such thing as coexistence. Once you introduce a GMO into the environment, there is no calling back. And you will destroy the organic farmer, and you will destroy the conventional farmer. You cannot have it in the same country. It will all become eventually GMOs. And that has happened to us in Western Canada with two crops now. We no longer have pure canola seed. Organic farmers no longer can grow canola. Organic farmers no longer can grow soybeans back home. It's all contaminated. Our choice has been taken away. What right has any company got, or what right has any individual have to destroy the property of others by introducing a substance or a life form that will destroy the property of others? No one should have that right. So my choice has been taken away with the introduction of GMOs. So there is no such thing as coexistence. Our choice is gone. And it doesn't only apply to the crops that GMOs are put into originally. Canola comes from the brassica family. It's got close relatives and distant relatives, but close relatives, radishes, turnips, and so on. Distant cousins like wild mustard. It is now cross-pollinating into those crops. Again, we'll be destroying future crops that organic farmers no longer can grow. What is the big fear now? The introduction of GMO wheat. And Monsanto has applied in both our countries for the introduction for regulatory approval of GMO wheat. And if that comes about, that would totally destroy the organic farmers. Wheat comes from the grass family. And it would be an economic issue. I have not touched on that. We've lost. We cannot sell one bushel of canola to the European Union. We've lost. Most countries of the world will not buy canola from us because it's all contaminated. If wheat comes out, 90% of, or 80, over 80% of our customers told us we will not buy GMO wheat from you. So the economic issue would be devastating. Now, in the Supreme Court, when they hear this case, there will be many issues they will be addressing. First of all, the patenting of life forms. There will be the liability issue, I believe. There will be issue of whether farmers will always maintain the right to use their own seed. But most of all, the most important, and this is what I was told yesterday, or the day before I left, is that by legal people, that there is a strong possibility that Monsanto will lose their rights to their patent. And that will be one of the greatest things, that they will not be able to patent or lose their patent on wheat and canola. I think I've spoken long enough, but I'd like to say a few more things. Is that, it, as I said, it has not been easy to stand up to a company. And I think all of us have to give a commitment. And there's a lot of younger generation people here. I'm 72 years of age. My wife is 71. And we know we don't know how many good years we got left. But we know the good years we got left, that we will go down fighting for the rights of farmers always to be able to use their own seed. Thank you.